Today's episode is brought to you by Musical Theater Radio's merch store. Looking for that perfect gift for someone or just want to treat yourself to some great musical theater themed merch? Head to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the All Things Theater button on the homepage and check out all the different designs available. And now, today's interview. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. Today is another Discover a New Musical Edition where you, the listener, and me, the host, get to learn about a new show together. Today, we are going to be speaking with Mark Iannicello about his new musical, The Finelli's Musical. It is the story of eternal optimist Tony Finelli, a New York Italian-American whose journey goes from stardom to jail and back again. Let's learn more about the show's creator and its upcoming run in June of 2024 by welcoming Mark Iannicello to the show. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem. Now, before we get into the show and all that fun stuff, we always get to know who you are. So I always ask for a 30-second bio. So who is Mark in 30 seconds?
30 seconds. I'm Italian. That's a very short amount of time. I'm actually an American, originally born in New York. I grew up in North Carolina. I started my career singing in the subway in Manhattan. I got crowned America's Best Street Performer by KFC, and that launched my very strange entertainment career. I sang opera for 30 years. I got tired of that. I got famous in Europe playing Elvis in a big musical about his life. And from there, I became a recording artist. And the last 10 years, I've mostly done film and TV. But now I'm back on stage with the Finelli's Musical in London.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Were you always into musical theater growing up, or is that something you discovered later?
Yeah, I was actually. I wanted to be Gordon McRae. I loved John Raitt. I loved Gordon McRae. I thought, you know, that's what I want to do with my life. Unfortunately, in my generation, they weren't making musical movies. I didn't want to do musicals on stage. I wanted to make musical films, you know, like in the 40s and the 50s, the heyday of that, even into the 60s. But, you know, from the mid 70s until Chicago, really, there was really nothing of import. And so I continued to I loved musicals. I loved, of course, Rodgers and Hammerstein and the Cole Porter shows. And how could you not love Ethel Merman? You know, my mother sounds a lot like Ethel Merman when she speaks. I have to hold the phone, you know, away from my ear when I'm talking. But I love music in all its forms, actually. And my very first roles were actually in musicals: Grease, Camelot, The Boyfriend, Bells Are Ringing. That's an old one, Judy Holliday vehicle. And then it developed, as my voice developed, I moved into operetta and opera, and then came back sort of full circle to where I began.
Were you always drawn to opera then, or just music in general? How'd you get into opera?
I never saw an opera until I sang one.
Wow.
My mother was a big fan of Mario Lanza, who I later wrote a musical about, strangely enough. Yes, I played in Vienna, was actually going to play in the UK as well, but we had song rights issues in the UK. And she, you know, said, you know, your voice is bigger than what you're using. So I started taking singing lessons, and then everybody said you should be an opera singer. Yeah. And I had never entertained that idea. But then the more you study, you know, the voice does what it does. And then I was very lucky. I sang Pinkerton and Madame Butterfly, mm-hmm. one of my first major roles. And my real thrust was really as an actor. I wanted to be an actor who sang. But I realized in opera, when it's really good, you're using the best of your acting ability, the best of your singing ability to tell these extraordinary stories with a 100-piece orchestra and no microphones, but counting. Yeah. So no, I always felt a bit out of place in the opera. I felt I had to cut off a big chunk of my personality, especially in the 80s mm-hmm. and 90s, before the three tenors kind of popularized opera. A classical singer was expected to behave a certain way, and I'm basically a clown, you know.
So I'm curious sometimes. You're obviously very into the music, very into performing. Was there ever another line of work you ever thought about going into? Was there anything that drew you?
Interesting question. Yes, I had considered being a lawyer for a short period of time because I like to argue. Ask anybody. I like being right. No, but you know, being an Italian and coming from New York, I was worried I'd end up working for the mafia, and I didn't want to do that. And then I considered for a while, for a long while, being an architect.
Okay.
Because I love mechanical things. I've got a tick for every kind of construction. You know, if I could have a steamroller and an excavator and a crane and a suspension bridge in my backyard, nothing would make me happier.
I'm always fascinated where we didn't go. You know,
yes.
It's always interesting where we go, but what would have happened if, right? I'm
yes.
always curious about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So you said you were, did I hear the entertainer of the year in the Subway? No, I'm trying to remember now back what you just said.
There was, you see, the thing was, I didn't want to be an opera singer. I had never planned that. And when I had to audition, I would nearly throw up, or sometimes actually threw up before my auditions. You'd go to these huge auditions in New York. And I was a kid from North Carolina. I was a New Yorker, but I grew up in North Carolina, where there is no, or there was no opera at that time. And I started to sing in the subway to get over my fear of auditions. So I would sing all the big, first I started off singing George Michael and REO Speedwagon. Then I started to sing opera arias in, you know, the underground. There was a program, a pilot program, called Music Under New York. And I was in the very first group of people, thousands of artists auditioned for it, because you got a permission, you got a, you know, time slots, and you got a, what do you call that? Yeah, like a legal permission to sing for certain periods of time. And I started making money hand over fist. In 1985, 1986, I was making $600 an hour singing in Grand Central Station. Because, of course, being the little entrepreneur that I am, I made cassettes of me singing arias. So I'd be singing live, selling cassettes, handing out my resume, and making change all at the same time. Because nobody had, you know, there were no touch cards. Nobody had these little mobile credit card things. This is all analog back then. And it got me, I realized that I would never, ever again wait for permission to do what I wanted to do. Singing in the subway gave me that. What happened a few years later, I had stopped singing in the subway because I had been discovered at Grand Central Station and made my Carnegie Hall debut singing. I had been singing, I don't know, Nessun Dorma or La Donna Immobile, and Eve Queller from the Opera Orchestra of New York heard me, bought one of my cassettes, took my resume, and her secretary called me and said she'd like you to audition for Roberta Devereux from Donizetti for Carnegie Hall. And that's how I went from the subway to singing in Carnegie Hall. Just before Carnegie Hall, I got a call from the MTA, Metropolitan Transportation Authority. They were the ones running that program, saying, listen, Kentucky Fried Chicken is doing a contest for the best street performer in America. And my story had already kind of come out about getting into Carnegie Hall. So you're our most successful performer. We'd like you to enter for New York. There were thousands of entries from all, they did auditions in Seattle and LA and Houston, Miami, and I was in the New York competition. So I came up with this idea of, what if Elvis never died? He just ate so much, he turned into Pavarotti. But, you know, you never saw them in the same room, if you think about it, you know? And so I came up with this number the night before the contest, where I would switch back and forth between It's Now or Never and O Sole Mio, which are the same song. And I'd switch from an operatic style to, oh, thank you very much. And I won the contest in New York. Then I did, the semifinals were in Times Square, in the center of Times Square. And then the finals, which I won, and then the finals were in Grand Central Station, which was my home turf. And I won the contest. And it was the first time My own creativity led me to success. I was not singing someone else's idea. I was singing my own. And that something clicked in my head after that. So yeah, I've been named the best street performer in America by Kentucky Fried Chicken. I ended up doing the Today Show, but with Bo Diddley, for God's sake. I sang at the Grand Ole Opry. I sang at, you know, the Apollo Theater in Harlem. I was in every newspaper in the US. And that's sort of how I got launched.
Life is way stranger than fiction. No,
oh, man, you can't make this shit up.
Right? And that is insane. Wow. Yeah, but did you get any free chicken or anything like that? Or just the recognition?
You know, I'm vegan now.
Oh.
But Kentucky Fried Chicken now has a vegan menu. They have vegan products, what? And they're very good. Back then, I was eating meat back then. But yes, I did. I got like chicken for a year. I don't remember. They were very kind. They were very generous. I was completely overwhelmed because it was like, you know, this is before cable. This is before the internet. This is all then. Everything was in real time. And I was traveling. They shipped me all over the country to do, you know, I sang with Elvis's band at the Grand Ole Opry. You know, it was weird. And it's funny. When I turned 60, I went back to Nashville. I'd not been back since then because I never got to see the theater from the front. Uh-huh. They flew me in, drove me backstage. I went on stage, did sound check, stayed backstage, did the show, got in the limo, went back to the airport and was in the next city. So it was really a very heady experience. And I have a great, great affinity for Kentucky Fried Chicken. They were very kind to me at a moment where I really needed it.
That's crazy. I don't even know how to get a segue to the musical, so I'm just going to jump right into it.
Well, sure. Why? Because I talk too much, right?
It's just the I'm going to use the word crazy, but in the good way of just everything that you just talked about. It's awesome. So, but there's no way to segue into it. So I'm just going to go, the finales, the musical. Okay. How did that come about in the first place?
Well, do you want to hear the backstory of this?
Of course, yeah.
The real story of what this musical, how this music came about.
For sure.
When I moved to Europe in 1994, I was singing at the Opera House in Zurich. Because of the Kentucky Fried Chicken number, by the way. So there's your segue.
There we go.
Perfect. I went from Kentucky Fried Chicken to the Zurich Opera. And I was in a very difficult marriage. And I ended up through a friend at Scientology. And I sort of got sucked into this whole machinery of that organization. When I moved to Europe, you know, I had started it in New York. I used to live right down the street from the big Scientology church on 46th. I didn't even know what it was. I thought it was the Church of Christian Science. Yeah. And anyway, I got into Scientology trying to save my marriage because Christian Italian boys don't get divorced, you know. And it was, hold on a minute. I'm going to have to close the door here.
Yeah, whoa. No problem.
And
that's live theater.
That's live theater.
Interviewed, yeah.
Yeah, and I got famous in Europe with Elvis. First, I did that. I got to give you another segue to get to that story. I was hired by the Zurich Opera House for the Young Artist Program. I was asked to sing the Kentucky Fried Chicken number. And in the audience was a man who was producing a big cinema music festival in Gstaad, you know, the ski resort. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to sing with Ben Weissman, who wrote 57 songs for Elvis, more than anybody else. He gave me an unreleased Elvis song called Will You Still Be There that Elvis was recording when he died. And that became my first record. From that record, I was hired to play Elvis in this gigantic musical production that toured Europe. Now, back to the story. I got famous with Elvis. Then Scientology came to me and said, listen, people are being discriminated against because of their religious beliefs, yada, yada, yada. Would you be willing to speak to the press? Stupid American stands up, John Wayne mentality, in a foreign country and said, In a democracy, a person has the right to believe as they so choose, as long as they hurt no person or impinge their beliefs on somebody else or break a law. It's all I ever said. That was enough to turn me into a target because there was a big movement in the late 90s, the mid to late 90s in Germany against sects, what they called dangerous sects that were undermining the German constitution. So I got stuck between the Scientology organization and the German equivalent of the CIA. It's called the Verfassungsschutz, the Office for the Constitution, for the Protection of the German Constitution. They couldn't get to Tom Cruise. They couldn't get to John Travolta, but I was a stage actor. Mm-hmm. So I had to have police protection. I was arrested. I had death threats. My phone was tapped. I lost millions of dollars in contracts. And I was blacklisted for 16 years. Long story short, in 2009, I tried to do Germany's Got Talent. It took me, I left Scientology in 2003. When the shit hit the fan, these guys left me to die. Hmm. I'm sorry, this is a long story, but if you want to know what the musical is about,
yeah.
You could edit me, darling. I won't be offended.
Anyway, no, I find this very fascinating. So,
well, I mean, it's a wild story, and it's so wild that people find it hard to believe. Right. But if you look on the internet, it's all there. I forgot where I was.
2000.
Yeah, in 2009, I tried to do Germany's Got Talent. I was going to use that as a vehicle to distance myself publicly from Scientology, try to rebuild my career. I did not audition. I didn't have a single audition for over 7 years. I went from being quite famous, making $60,000 a month playing Elvis, to not getting a job anywhere overnight. And then, of course, the protests started and the death threats and the police protection and all the rest of it. When I left Scientology, it took me 6 years to get that mind fuck out of my head. I did this Germany's Got Talent. When I didn't answer their questions the way they wanted, they wanted me to trash Tom Cruise, who I don't know, or John Travolta. I was willing to talk about what my experience was with that organization, but not about these people I don't know. They kicked me off the show after trying to have me booed on live TV. And that was the moment that something snapped. I wrote a book called Naked in the Spotlight. You can look it up on, it's on Amazon. It's in German and in English. The big TV interview in German with subtitles. And I sent it to the German CIA with an official letter publicly distancing myself from Scientology. A year later, I started getting work again after 16 years. So I decided to go back to the country that tried to destroy me and make myself famous there. So that's why I went back on TV. After a year of doing TV and movies, once they started to broadcast them, then I knew the projects that the Scientology problem had been solved, because they would film things with me but never broadcast it because they got, you know, from above, they were told they can't do it. I then started hearing from TV producers, you know, you're a great TV personality, you should have your own format. And they wanted me to do like Keeping Up with the Kardashians or something like that.
Yeah.
But I'm too private a person for that. So I came up with the idea of The Finales, about an American singer who goes to prison to save his family from being killed by the mafia. Well, the prison sentence is a one-to-one analogy for my years in the sect. You know, you can't do a musical about Scientology. They're very litigious. They'll sue you in a second.
Yeah.
And I took that story and I tried to make it understandable how somebody gets into this machine and can't get out. They're, you know, I make you an offer you can't refuse. So it started out as a TV series. We finished filming 3.5 episodes when the pandemic hit. We had just started to promote the show. And then, of course, you couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't do anything. So we put it in festivals. We got 64 award nominations, won 22 awards in 12 countries. And I thought, okay, we've done something right. And when we, of course, at that time, getting funding for anything was also almost impossible during the pandemic. So I wrote a new connecting storyline. We went back into production and we turned the footage we had into a movie, which is The Finales movie, which is on Apple and Amazon and all of that. that got really was very, very well received, as you'll hear. And then we raised the money actually to do the series. And I had a big Hollywood name on board to play my manager. And I had a really bad feeling about my partners in LA. I just didn't want to move forward because if I take money from an investor, I want to make sure I can make it a success. Sure. So we put everything on ice. And then about 6 months later, I called Wolf Weidman, the composer. And I said, what do you think if we turn the show into a musical? And we started writing, turning the book scenes into, there were songs in the film anyway, but we started turning the scenes into songs. And within a few months, because I had already written the whole first season, we had written quite a few songs already. So we put it together. We did a producer's presentation in May last year here in London. And I raised enough money that day to do the production that we are now doing. This show was actually supposed to have happened in November, but my father passed away. And I had to postpone everything because I was grieving too much. And so, yeah, it's the story of a man who goes to prison, even though he's innocent, to save his family from being killed by the mafia. When he comes out, his wife has turned his mansion into a bed and breakfast. And to win back his family and restart his career, he takes the job as the janitor in his own house, even though he's got two left hands and he's completely useless. So that's the story of the Finelles.
Wow. The backstory was worth it. So thank you.
I needed Tony Finelli as a mask to hide behind. Great comedy often comes from horrific experiences or pain. You know, Life is Beautiful with Benigni won the Oscar for the Holocaust thing. I'm not comparing my situation to the Holocaust in any way, of course, but I know what it is to lose everything. And the purpose of this show is I want to give people hope. You never give up. You never lay down and die. You stand up and you fight. And Tony is a bit like Rocky Balboa, you know, he takes a licking and keeps on ticking, that kind of thing. And I wrote it as close to myself as I could stand it, because some of the stuff was very, very painful. And even today, even though I have quite a bit of distance from the situations now, and Tony, in the meantime, has become a character quite separate from Mark. Certain things, certain scenes really touch me. And it's that authenticity that helped us with a sitcom win awards all over the world. And I'm trusting that the audiences, the musical theater audiences, will respond to the authenticity. Every character in this show, with the exception of one, is based on a real person.
So obviously, you are a performer. We know that part. You wrote the music and lyrics and everything.
No, I'm a lyricist. I'm not. Okay. I have no ear for melody, amazingly. Wolf Weidman, who was my very first record producer on that unreleased Elvis song, and then when I played Elvis, we did a big album for the musical. He and I have been working together since 1997, on and off. Mm. He's the composer. I'm the lyricist, and I wrote the book.
So tell us about your process. Had you written songs before, or what's your process?
I always was a poet. Even when I was a young man and starting out in New York, I had a journal of poetry that I would keep from just experiences that I saw. I had written quite a few songs, but when I met with Ulf, he was able to make my words sing in a way that nobody else had. So once we started writing together, that's when things really took off. And I had written six other musicals, but they were sort of jukebox musicals. You know, we did a musical about Mario Lanza that used a lot of Lanza songs and Italian folk songs and yada, yada, yada. There was another one about Enrico Caruso that I was to have done. I did write there were a couple of original pieces. Charlie and Cloud Nine is a children's musical that I've written. But this is the first time that I am presenting. I'm more proud of this show than anything I've ever done in my now very long career. I've invested 9 years of my life and almost $500,000 to get the show this far. So I'm not playing around with this, you know?
Well, that, totally understandable. You know, a lot of it's your story or based around some of this you've experienced. Yeah. You're writing it. It's one thing to write like you said, a jukebox musical about Lonza or whatever. But now this is your baby. Right?
This is my baby. These are people that I know. Yeah. I had to do them all justice and make the story palatable for people who know nothing about Mark Canicello or my life. And, you know, I want to inspire people. And in Italian, you have a word, chiaroscuro. They use it for painting, darkness and light. Mm-hmm. Without the shadows, there can be no light. So as funny as the show is, and it's very, very funny, there are moments of great stillness and very quiet moments and some moments that are quite heartbreaking because you can't show that what happens to a man or anyone, that's not just a man, happens to women, happens to everybody. There's a transgender character in our show because my very first job working in Germany was with a very famous transgender actress in Germany. And I had never met a transgender person in person. And I flipped out. I did not know how to behave. I was not rude. I was not, unprofessional in any way, but I kept my distance. And how we became friends and realized how much we had in common. I took that story, fictionalized it, of course, and I put it in the finales because I want other people to understand that underneath, all of us just want to be seen. We just want to be seen and understood. You don't have to agree with me, but you have to acknowledge that I exist.
Mm-hmm. 100%. 100%. I like to ask, because I'm always curious, when you're writing your songs, when you wrote them, yes, was there any one that just flowed out of you? Just so easy to write. And then was there one that you just went, what am I doing with this song? How am I going to make this work?
One of the first songs that Ulf and I wrote was called The Journey. Usually I write the lyrics first. But this time there was a melody that he had written for something else. And I heard it and I said, I hear a song. And I wrote that lyric that came just like nothing. There was the big 11 o'clock number in the show is called Here I Am Again. It's like the greatest James Bond song you've never heard. That one was more difficult because I had to distill the essence of my life into a 3-minute package and finding without being too specific so that it remains universal to find the things that people can relate to while still being enchanted by this extraordinary melody. Fantastic. That one was tough.
So let's talk about the production that's happening in June. Like, again, how did that come about? How did you get it? Anything you can tell us about it?
Well, as I said, we had done a producer's presentation. It was sold out, and the audience loved the show. I've been on stage since I'm 4 years old. I know when an audience is with you, and they laughed at all the right places. They loved the songs. They just loved the characters. And we had some investors there. And with a few phone calls afterwards, I was able to put enough money together to do this 16 performance run. I wanted to do a full production of, I wanted to do a production of the entire show. We had only done act one. Mm-hmm. So once I was able to raise the money, I started writing act two. And then we started casting, and then my father got ill, as I said. We put everything on hold. And then when we had done the producer's presentation, I hired some big name actors for that from the UK. And this time I thought, no, I'm going to hire the best person for the job. We saw 1,600 people for 11 jobs, and we did not advertise it publicly. This was only through agent submission. Hmm. And we whittled it down from 1,600 to 80 for the final callbacks. And then we did 2 days of in-person auditions. And from that, we got our cast. We have an extraordinary cast, Mike Sterling, who is playing Jürgen, my manager. He's played the Phantom of the Opera in the West End 1,000 times. He's played Jean Valjean. Colette Kelly, who plays my mother, is from the original Broadway, the original West End cast of Hair and Grease. And in fact, Elaine Page
Mm-hmm.
was her understudy
Wow.
in Hair. And through Colette, we've been able to contact Elaine, and she's coming to the premiere.
That's very cool.
You know, we have marvelous young actors, Jake Policino playing young Tony Finelli in the movie. We go back and forth in time. On stage, of course, we needed two sets of actors. Anna Maria is playing young Tina Finelli and Lola, my oldest daughter, and a marvelous young actress named Pippa Juliet is playing my younger daughter, Lena. Lola is all heart and no brain. Lena is all brain and no heart, you know, as well as this Bridezilla, daughter of the mafia boss, Aurora Gambaretto. And for Mr. Big, we have a double role also. Michael Christopher, a wonderful actor based in Liverpool, who is going to be playing my father and Mr. Big, the mafia boss. Really a phenomenal cast. Marky Thompson is playing the transgender character, Ava Klein. She is a phenomenal songwriter in her own right. She's written number one hits for K-pop and Japanese pop stars and a few British pop stars. This is her first, she's her coming out transgender role, her first transgender role since transitioning. And this girl can sing like nobody's business. She's got a phenomenal, phenomenal song called The Woman in the Mirror about visualizing her future and how it came to be, which I got goosebumps talking about it right now. Wow. Anyway, yeah, that's our cast.
Very nice. And the creative team, the directors, and are you taking care of that yourself? Who's
I'm the director. We have a wonderful choreographer named Adam Haig, who has done quite a lot here in London. We interviewed so many people for that job, but he kind of got the feel of the show better than some of the others that we had spoken to. They were all wonderfully talented. Ulf Eidman, who has been, musical director for some of the biggest pop stars in the world, Christopher Cross, and all of these, Christa Berg, all of these people, he's actually being the musical director of the production itself. We have our lighting and sound people. We have a wonderful young Irish woman, Caitlin, wait a minute, I forgot her last name. Oh, my God.
I put you on the spot, so yeah.
As I know. We've got a wonderful team doing our costumes and light and sound. So and because Wonderville does not have a very large stage, it's a wonderful, we're right 2 minutes away from Piccadilly Circus, right next door to the Phantom of the Opera. It's a wonderful theater, but the stage is not very large, so we're using video projections and pre-recorded orchestra for the set and sound, because there's not room for a live band. So all of that, we've got full orchestrations. It sounds amazing. It's going to look amazing. If you can't tell, I'm very excited. Talk amongst yourselves.
You should be. You've earned it, and it sounds like a fantastic show.
Are you coming? June 5th. Come walk the red carpet.
I'm in Toronto. I feel like getting over there's a little bit.
You're an international radio star. Talk to the people at musical theater radio.
If I could go through the airwaves like the radio does, sure, I'll be there. But physically, I'm unfortunately able to. But we're doing this interview earlier than the show, a couple of months. Have you gotten into rehearsals yet, or you're prepping for all that stuff?
We're in the final prep stages. We start rehearsal on May 20th. The cast has had the script and the songs since January. Actually, so they've all been working. I've been, learning my lines because I wrote it, but I've never played it. Yeah. Not this stuff. This is so this, it's a huge amount of responsibility. And I have to be very, very well prepared when we start rehearsal, because we have a short rehearsal period to put this gigantic show together. But I know this story inside and out. So, yeah.
Well, Mark, congratulations on the show. It sounds fantastic. I know you're busy with this, but do you have anything else in the pipeline you'd want to promote that you want to talk about or let people know about?
Well, I'm writing a screenplay for a horror film, a thriller called Hotel Bristol, which is something I've been working on a little bit on the side right now. I'm kind of buried in this. There are a few other film and TV projects that are in discussion. But until I'm done with this, I'm kind of focusing on that and on the screenplay, because that I can do from home. You know?
Makes sense. I totally get it. I always like to ask, if we can help promote.
You never know. Yeah.
So how do people get to know more about you, the socials, website, where to buy tickets for the upcoming show in June and all that fun stuff?
Well, you can go to www.thefinellis.com. There's a very large website there. If you look up Mark Janicello, Janicello, I'm the only one in the world. You'll come right to my website. I've got, you know, every social media except TikTok. I can't be bothered with that one. But, you know, where the Finellis and Mark Janicello are kind of everywhere. And you can buy tickets directly online through the website. It'll take you directly to the ticketing agencies. If you're going to be in London between June 3rd, we start previews June 3rd, opening night is June 5th. Until June 16th, we're doing 8 shows a week. We'd love to have you join us.
That's fantastic. And we'll start promoting it about a month out on our socials and let people know.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. Have you heard Here I Am Again yet?
I have, and I'm going to be adding it to the rotation of our station as soon as I get a chance to just put it up. Because
is that not a ridiculous note at the end of the song?
It is. It's a great song. And I'm glad, because I asked, is it okay if I put it on the station? Because I wasn't sure if it was allowed. And she said, and so it will be out there, and I will get.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. One more question before we go. Sure. So which was more intimidating, the German Secret Service people or the patrons in a New York subway listening to you sing? Which can be frightening more?
They were very different. When I got arrested in Munich, I thought I was going to get shot. Yeah. That was not a joke. And it was, you know, people are screaming at you in a foreign language. I do speak German, but to hear that aggression coming towards you. When I would sing in the subway, it was a very, very life-affirming experience. Homeless people would come and give me money.
Wow.
People thought that I was lip-singing. They didn't believe I was singing live. So I would laugh or cough in the middle of songs just so they could understand I was actually singing live. Yeah. And like some homeless people would come right up to my face, half a foot from me, just to make sure it was real. Or they would stand there, and sometimes they would cry. The audiences in the New York subway were so appreciative. I was a young guy, and I was, you know, making my way into the big bad world of entertainment. And they gave me the courage and the support to say, I can do this. Look at what's happening here. I would open my mouth and hundreds of New Yorkers would stand still. So I knew I was doing something right, regardless of what was happening at auditions.
Yeah,
you know, you don't make that kind of bank singing on the street unless you got something to offer. So, no, the German Secret Service, they were way more intimidating. But, yeah, thanks for asking.
Because you hear the stories about the New York subway, and, you know, I've been on it, and, you know, it's not as bad sometimes.
New Yorkers develop a radar for criminals.
Yeah.
You have to. Back in the 80s and the early 90s, especially after the stock market crashed in the late 80s, New York was wild, man. It was really scary. There were homeless people everywhere. We don't have a proper social system in place in the United States to care for people who have special needs and need additional support. That in Europe is somewhat better, especially in the German countries. Mm-hmm. New York can be a frightening place.
Well, it's still a good place to go visit and see.
Oh, gosh, yeah. And who knows? Maybe we'll go from the West End to Broadway. You never know, right?
You never know. If you go to Broadway, then I will be able to get down there, and I will definitely
check. Oh, please. You can't be bothered with jet lag, right?
The lag part's okay. It's the money part.
I understand.
I hear you. Mark, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule. Thank you so much. And we'll be promoting the heck out of it. And I look forward to seeing where the show goes in the future.
Well, there will be some video and audio recordings made. So I'll make sure we get something over to you.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So we were just speaking with Mark Iannicello about his new musical, The Finellis Musical. So if you are in London, go to the West End, Wonderville. It's right beside the Phantom. So, you know.
That's right on the Haymarket is the name of the street.
Perfect. June 3rd to the 16th of 2024. So go check that out. Tune in next week as we'll speak with another guest or guests about their life, love, and passion that is musical theater. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Jovanoff. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you.